You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 1st of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Do people fighting wars pay much attention to papal prayers for peace? Were Turkey's local elections merely the latest battle in the eternal struggle between city and country? And there's an escaped rhinoceros in our courtyard. Yes, it's April Fool's Day, etc. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Lynn O'Donnell and Simon Brook, will discuss today's big stories, and we'll meet the director of a new documentary reflecting the endeavours of ordinary Ukrainians to assist in the defence of their country. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and we are going to start with some breaking news. Israel has bombed the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus. The embassy building itself appears substantially undamaged, and the ambassador is believed to be unharmed, but the airstrike destroyed an adjacent annex. At least six people are reported dead, among them Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior officer in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. I'm joined with more on this by Lina Khatib, a director of the SOAS Middle East Institute. Lina, obviously this is an unfolding story, but do we know much more than that for certain?
Well, what we know is that Israel has been attacking Iranian targets inside Syria for a while, but this is a very high-profile attack. Israel had not before attacked the consulate of Iran. It had limited its attacks in the past to military targets. So this does seem like an escalation on part of Israel.
It obviously brings to mind the assassination by an American drone strike in Baghdad a couple of years ago of General Qassem Soleimani, the former commander of the IRGC. Compared to a figure like Soleimani, perhaps, how significant was Zahedi?
I would say he is nowhere near as significant. He was the leader of the elite Quds Force, which is part of the IRGC. He was leader of that until 2016. He served as commander of the IRGC in Syria and Lebanon, but he was not a region-wide commander like Soleimani was, because Soleimani led the whole of the IRGC's operations across the Middle East, really. But what is going on here, which is important, is that by targeting him and the consulate, Israel is sending a strong message to Iran about Iran's vulnerability inside Syria.
He's obviously not the first Iranian individual to have been targeted by Israel. A sequence of mishaps have befallen Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years, which are widely assumed to be the work of Israeli intelligence, and certainly Israel's denials have been half-hearted at best. Do we learn anything from the Iranian response to those attacks, which gives us some idea of how they may respond to this one?
Well, let's face it. When Qasem Soleimani was assassinated, and we have to remember that it was the US that assassinated Qasem Soleimani, not Israel. He was assassinated in Iraq. At the time, there was wide expectation that there was going to be a huge response by Iran, and that response never happened. So if it didn't happen then, it's not going to happen now. I think what's going on is Israel is seeing how vulnerable Iran is in context of all what's happening in the region right now, and is taking advantage of Iran's vulnerability to increase the pressure, knowing that Iran will not be able to really respond in any great shape or form.
Lena, just finally, as you mentioned earlier, this is very far from isolated in terms of Israeli action in Syria in recent, well, years, really. And just a couple of days ago, there were quite large-scale airstrikes across Syria aimed not exclusively, but apparently primarily at targets related to Hezbollah, which is, of course, an Iranian ally. In that context, would a strike like this today be related at all to the ongoing conflict in Gaza, or is this being, would this be thought of as Israel as something entirely separate, a continuation of a war they were already fighting before October 7th?
It is a mixture of both, because Israel had been targeting Iranian assets inside Syria for years. This is, in a way, a continuation. However, because of the escalated value of this particular target, and because Israel has been increasing the number of these attacks since the situation in Gaza began to unfold, we can see that this is an indication that Israel's stance towards this Iranian presence in Syria has changed. Perhaps in the past, Israel thought that it could live with this Iranian presence in Syria, but the situation in Gaza with Hezbollah attacking from the north and with Iran-backed groups in Syria and Iraq also being involved, and that's not to mention the Houthis in the Red Sea, all of these are Iran-backed armed groups that have activated and escalated their own attacks on Israel since the situation in Gaza began. All this means that Israel is beginning to rethink its own level of tolerance of Iran's presence in Syria, and we're likely to see more escalation on Israel's part.
Lena Khatib, thank you as always for joining us. There will, of course, be more on that story across Monocle's shows tomorrow. But for now, this is The Daily. This is the Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Miller, and I am joined today by Lynn O'Donnell, columnist for Foreign Policy magazine, and by Simon Brook, journalist and communications consultant. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Simon, first of all, how does a journalist and communications consultant spend his Easters these days?
Well, apart from eating too much chocolate, which is traditional, isn't it? I've been doing quite a bit of dog walking for one reason or another, and the reason I say that is that for most of my life, I've been very anti-dog. I come from an anti-dog family.
That would be a controversial view here at the Norrie House.
Well, can I just say quickly, I need to pivot very quickly to say that a few years ago, I had a dog foisted on me, shall we say, in that my partner bounced me into dog ownership. And I'm now a complete dog enthusiast. I have to say, it's got me away from my desk, out into the fresh air. It's amazing for your social life. I mean, genuinely, we have met some wonderful people and got some new friends because of the way the dog has introduced them to us.
And Lynn, you, as I understand it, have been walking largely without a dog.
I have in recent days, that's right, taking advantage of breaks in the seemingly unrelenting rain in London to get out and about. Yeah.
I do kind of think, Lynn, even as a fellow Australian, complaining about the weather is one of those things you can't really do when you have voluntarily moved to London.
You know, I'm from Melbourne, and so we do weather. We do weather probably better than most places in the world.
Melbourne famously does all of it at once, all the time. The local joke, which I'm sure you've heard many times, is if you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes.
Yeah, indeed. Whereas in London, if you don't like the weather, leave.
Well, nobody ever came here for the weather, did they? Exactly.
Well, indeed not. But we will start with the traditional Easter message from the Pope. Speaking at Easter Mass at the Vatican yesterday, Pope Francis called for peace and so forth. Granted that this sounds very much like what you'd expect the Pope to say at Easter, or indeed any time, and granted that it would really have been headline news if His Holiness had mounted the pulpit and quoted extensively from George C. Scott as General George S. Patton. But yesterday's message specifically cited Gaza as ripe for a ceasefire, called for an exchange of prisoners between Ukraine and Russia, and warned nations in general against the self-fulfilling perils, as he sees it, of tooling themselves up. Lynn, as somebody who has reported from several zones of conflict, has it struck you at any point that any of the protagonists thus enmeshed were likely to pay much attention if the Pope asked them to knock it off?
The protagonist, probably not, but I think it should be noticed that a lot of the wars that take place across the world in history are done so in the name of religion, mm-hmm. including past papal wars. The Pope, I think there are, what, 1.5 billion, nearly 1.5 billion Catholics
give
in
or
the
take.
World. And then probably the rest of the world is also led by patriarchs and grand muftis and archbishops and Dalai Lamas and whatever, all of whom seem to be overwhelmingly men, but let's not go into the religious patriarchy. I think that the Pope's message is probably very closely followed and listened to by people who aren't using war to justify their own existence.
I mean, Simon, as a specialist in the field of communications, is not a message like this worthy, though it is somewhat reduced by its predictability? As I was intimating, he was never going to get up and say, choke their rivers with dead and till the scorched earth with salt.
No, that's a very Old Testament view. But I think what's interesting here in this particular case is obviously that Pope Francis has, as you say, stressed that there should be a ceasefire, but also the return of Israeli hostages. When it comes to Ukraine, of course, he has got quite an interesting history, and he is quite controversial. You remember a few weeks ago, he said that Ukraine should have, or one of the sides, Russia or Ukraine, should have the courage to raise the white flag, which obviously upset a lot of people in Kyiv and across the West. His spokesperson talked about the fact that this was negotiation, not capitulation. But just shortly after the Russian invasion, he also said that that Russia had been provoked by NATO, quote, barking at Russia's door. When you consider that NATO has only accounts for about 4% of the border of Russia's, must be pretty
and
loud.
That everybody who has ever joined it has done so voluntarily.
Absolutely. So, in fact, there is a bit of controversy here. And I think the other issue to look at is this question of there's peace and there's justice, and they are very often two different things. So you could certainly have peace when Russia completely obliterates Ukraine and puts its forces on the ground. You've got peace in North Korea, but you haven't got justice. So I think it's a religious, it's a political, it's a moral question about there are times when you actually have to fight for justice and you can't have peace.
Lynn, as Simon correctly points out, he has been yelled at once or twice before, and not without reason, for some of his statements on Ukraine. Do you think that might be the reason he was a bit woollier on Ukraine in his Easter message? Basically, he just said, may the risen Christ open a path of peace for the war-torn peoples of those regions, which again does prompt the somewhat glib response, in your own time, the risen Christ.
When you get around to it. Maybe so. I don't think the Pope was deliberately courting the sort of controversy that you've mentioned, Simon. I think that his message is fundamentally one of peace, and he may have been trying to get to, in earlier messages, the nub of how do you get to that peace, and what destroyed the whatever. But I think that maybe his message was to ameliorate the controversy that he sparked with recent comments. But I think that he is genuinely a messenger of peace.
Just finally on this, Simon, going back to your point about peace versus justice, and I have spoken to more than one exasperated diplomat in my time who has attempted to involve themselves in conflict resolution and has wanted to say to the parties, seriously, peace, justice, pick one. But the Pope also said something along the lines of, peace is never made with arms, but with outstretched hands and open hearts. Again, a very papal thing to say, but it's one of those statements that you, it's like that one you often see at placards on demonstrations, that there never was a good war or a bad peace. It's just not true. Peace is often made with arms, either by the use of them or the threat of them. Do we think he doesn't know that isn't true, or does he just not care?
I think it's really difficult. I think, as you say, Lynn, he's got to have a message of peace. It would be very difficult. But on the other hand, I would say that if you look at, for instance, the life of Jesus Christ, he didn't do any kind of shabby deals, did he? He didn't actually go after peace. He was a man of principle as well. So I think it's a really difficult call for the Pope. I do think, to answer your first point, Andrew, that it is important that people like the Pope, with that kind of supranational, non-political position, say these things. But for everybody who comes from a religious background, it's a question of saying something that is different, that is insightful, that is a bit but is relevant, but doesn't look sort of woolly. And, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? So he's treading a very fine line here. But, yeah, ultimately peace is the aim, but it's got to be a just peace, hasn't it?
Well, let's move along to India. And voting in India's epic general election begins later this month, but some Indians have been voting already. In a number of jurisdictions in Europe, Canada and the United States, Sikhs have been voting in a rolling referendum on the idea of an independent Sikh state, Khalistan, to be carved out of India's north. The idea of a sovereign Sikh nation is not a new one, and indeed efforts to make it a reality got somewhat militant during the 1980s, up to and including the assassination of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and the bombing of an Air India jumbo jet with the loss of all aboard. More recently, relations between India and Canada have been roiled by the murder in British Columbia of a Canadian Sikh activist, which Canada blamed on India's government. Lynn, first of all, to the general principle, it is somewhat arbitrary whether or not one bunch of people get to call themselves a sovereign nation and another people don't. And if we think in terms, well, of exactly that, the Sikhs' claims on nationhood, in theory, they're certainly not any sillier than anybody else's, and they're quite a lot more plausible than many.
Are they? to be honest with you, I think a lot of people involved in the Khalistan Republic movement, if that's what it is, are a little bit dodgy, as you mentioned.
Oh, indeed,
the,
so.
Yeah, the characters, figures involved in the Canadian controversy and in America more recently are questionable, and they have been suspected of involvement of that terrible Air India bombing in the mid 1980s, and I don't know how valid this is, to be honest with you. I think that if India did send agents into Canada and into the United States against Free Khalistan figures, then that is as outrageous as, you know, the Russians sending people into the United Kingdom, or the Americans sending people everywhere that they have sent them in the past to assassinate public figures. The lobbying for a Khalistani state, an independent Khalistan, seems to be going on principally outside the country. And I think that in itself makes it a little bit wishy-washy.
Simon, is something like this, though, perhaps an inevitable result of, or an inevitable reaction to, the aggressive nationalism we have seen of Prime Minister Narendra Modi in India during his time in charge? He has a very narrow idea, in practice at least. In theory, he observes the sort of official pabulum about India being a broad and diverse state. But there's very little doubt that he is quite an ethnocentric Hindu nationalist.
Yeah, this idea of Hindutva, this is sort of religious political nationalism, which is firing up the BJP's power base. Openly says that India's identity is very much inseparable from Hinduism. And of course, you know, the key figure in this story is Narendra Modi. And as you say, the fact that he is making his country very uncomfortable, not just for Muslims, but for Christians as well. So, just recently, we've seen demonstrations in the north of the country with confrontation between Christians and Hindus and others. He is making life, as I say, very difficult for them. And I think across, sort of in terms of the international context, this is really difficult for a lot of other countries as well, because they really want to do business with India. They want India, the world's fastest growing economy, to be a bulwark for against autocracy, to be a supporter of democracy. And of course, we've seen in the last few years, Chatham House, but other organisations similarly have changed it from being Freedom House, have downgraded its status from being a free democracy to a partially free democracy. And there are also concerns now, coming back to, Ukraine and Russia, about the fact that India is sort of soft on Putin, if you like. That might go back to Soviet connections with India. But there's a lot of hope, I think, that Narendra Modi will do the right thing and be embracing all the different cultures and religions of India and be a Democrat, but he's certainly not going in that direction.
Lynn, in the pantheon of political stunts, do you think this rolling referendum is going to be effective? I mean, it's obviously not going to register in the slightest with Indian authorities. It is very far from official. And I think almost by definition, you're not going to get an awful lot of no voters bothering to turn up to this. But from the point of view of the people who are organising it, is it actually an effective rallying tool? Does it work in that it folds people into the movement? It makes them feel like they're part of something, that there is this roadshow with momentum.
I doubt that. But I think the success that it has, we're talking about it, it highlights issues around Sikh nationhood and identity. And as you were saying, Simon, it also helps to highlight this apparent move by Modi to entrench Hinduism as the national identity. You know, I was recently in India, and a couple of people that I was spending time with said to me, what's the impression, just apropos of nothing, what's the impression of Modi outside of the country? And I mentioned his populism, and I, you know, they found it very difficult to grasp what I was talking about until I put it in terms of the Donald Trump of India. They were they cannot grasp. These are all, you know, young professionals, successful, middle class Hindu people, and they couldn't grasp the image of Modi in those terms at all.
Just finally on this, Lynn, while we have you here, and with all due deference to the fact that we absolutely understand that India and Pakistan are two entirely different countries, but it is a country you know well and have reported on extensively. Imran Khan, former Prime Minister, his 14-year sentence for selling state gifts was suspended today. There'll be a decision after the Eid holidays, though he is, of course, also doing time for various other things. Does he have any actual options left to him at this point, or is he just going to be left to rot in jail?
Well, there's a few people in Pakistan I've spoken to about what's going on with Imran Khan who think that these moves are taking it closer to the government, the new government, being able to let him go, even if he's sent home under house arrest or, you know, with an ankle bracelet on or something. You're right. This is only a 14-year sentence out of something like 170 years. He's not getting out anytime soon. But it is an indication that the attitude of the government and the judiciary that is largely compliant are wanting to make things a little bit easier for him, I think.
Mm. Well, to Turkey now. And at its presidential election last May, the optimistically anticipated popular revolt against long-serving President Recep Tayyip Erdogan failed to materialise. At local elections this weekend, it very much did. Erdogan's Justice and Development, or AK party, received the sort of hosing which reduces a fellow to intoning through gritting teeth about a victory for democracy, as indeed Erdogan did. AK got especially roundly trounced in Turkey's west and or its big cities. The great prize of the mayoralty of Istanbul, which Erdogan once held himself, was retained by Ekrem İmamoğlu, who Erdogan has attempted to finagle out of Turkish politics through various means. Simon, first of all, regular listeners to The Daily, like there are any other kind, etc., will be aware of one of my pet theories of everything, which is that pretty much everything does boil down to the eternal conflict between city and country. Rural versus urban, modernity versus not modernity. Is that what's happening here?
It does look like it, doesn't it? As you say, I mean, you mentioned Trump just a moment ago, Lynn.
And a prime example of that.
Absolutely. And we see across, we see here in the UK, we, you know, look across the channel, you've got the same situation in France and other countries. And it certainly does seem to be that, that the situation very similar to that in Turkey. And we've seen in previous elections that Erdogan has done very well amongst the conservative religious classes, groups outside the big cities. So It's obviously a bit of a slap in the face for him that that he's done so badly and that his arch rival has done so well in this election. But to what extent that will damage this very wily, very tenacious politician, I'm really pleased. It's great for democracy. And it's particularly nice, as you say, the fact that that Erdogan has tried all these court cases and other ways of silencing Ekrem İmamoğlu. And despite all that, that İmamoğlu has done very well. But I think we shouldn't hold our breath about any kind of imminent change of government and sort of more democratic way of being in Turkey.
Well, indeed not. And President Erdogan Lin is, of course, safely ensconced on yet another term. But is he the kind of politician, wily and tenacious as Simon is, who will adjust himself in the face of getting a battering like this? The usual tendency of populists is just to double down or suggest that the whole thing is some sort of conspiracy, which, to Erdogan's minor credit, he appears to show no inclination to do. He has copped it on the chin. But is he likely to change at all?
Well, it's a midterm election cycle, isn't it?
And which is traditionally when the national government usually gets beaten up anyway.
Well, that's right. And a lot of voters see midterm elections as an opportunity to do that. Inflation is officially 67%, which means it's probably closer to 100%. And I've lived in Turkey and at times of incredibly high inflation. And it's really tough living in, you know, basically triple figure inflation, and people need to send a message to their incompetent leaders when life is becoming unaffordable and unsustainable. And I think that, you know, there were those big earthquakes last year where thousands of people died. Was it more than 50,000 people died? And a lot of the recrimination around that was those deaths was around corruption and being able to buy off authorities and property developers putting money in their pockets. And I think that Erdogan needs this slap if he is going to listen, if he is going to turn things around for when he comes up to the chopping block again in 4 years' time.
Simon, we did want to think about a bit the role of mayors as potential bulwarks against populism, because they do run these big cities. Obviously, that's pretty much the job description. And big cities tend not to be all that susceptible to the blandishments of xenophobes, populists, etc., etc., and especially not a huge cosmopolitan city like Istanbul. Is that a role that more mayors could perhaps be encouraged to play?
Well, it's interesting to see what's happening here in the UK, where we've got mayors like Andy Burnham, who is the mayor of the great Liverpool area, and also Andy Street of the combined West Midlands Authority. So through the teeth of opposition from the central government in Westminster, we've seen these mayors get more power, more autonomy, and they are delivering. And I think what's interesting is both those Andys, Burnham and Street, and also other mayors we're seeing as well, are going very much on the sort of locality, our deliverables, I'm doing a good job for you, and are stepping aside from party politics. So I think it's a good thing, because I think devolution is always a good thing. Bring it down to the local people and let them have the budgets, the autonomy to decide what's best for them. So it certainly helps. Obviously, there are people who have used a mayoralty as a stepping block, a stepping stone.
Erdogan among them.
Erdogan, absolutely. Here we are in London. So Boris Johnson, of course, was mayor of London. Look what happened to him. across the channel, Jacques Chirac was mayor of Paris for nearly 20 years before he came president of France. Rodrigo Duterte was a mayor of the Filipino city of Davao for 25 years before he came prime minister. So it is a way of establishing yourself as a politician who delivers. Because if you're just a legislature, you can say, I voted for this or I voted against that. But if you're a mayor, you can say, look, you know, the trains are on time, the streets are clean, I've done this. So for better or for worse, it certainly, as I say, is a great platform.
Lynn, just finally on this, the streets being clean and trains running on time are not boasts which can credibly be made by the mayor of this city, Sadiq Khan, who faces re-election in May as well. But in his defence, and other occupants of that office, Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone, each have complained that the power of the Mayor of London is somewhat circumscribed when compared to mayors elsewhere. There's things they would like to do but actually cannot. As a general principle, should mayors have more power than they do? Are you some sort of crazed devolutionist like Simon?
I do like the idea of devolution, but I also see that there's an awful lot of councils in the UK that are neck deep in debt, some of them billions and billions of pounds in debt, and that is through their own incompetence. So I think it swings and roundabouts. Birmingham has been very lucky in having Andy Burnham, that's for sure. He's very competent and very active. But if I lived somewhere else...
Parts of Essex, instance, Croydon, south of London.
Where I don't have buses. The tyres of my car are being wrecked by potholes. There's no libraries. The teachers are buying equipment in schools. The schools themselves are falling apart. I don't think I'd be a big fan of devolution under those circumstances.
Well, moving along to today's date, which is April 1st, i.e. All Fool's Day, and we wish to make it clear that all the events discussed in today's daily are things which have, in fact, actually happened. This is because we at Monocle Radio have no sense of humour whatsoever and therefore will not stoop to such puerile prankery as the BBC's Panorama did back in 1957.
The last 2 weeks of March are an anxious time for the spaghetti farmer. There's always the chance of a late frost, which, while not entirely ruining the crop, generally impairs the flavour and makes it difficult for him to obtain top prices in world markets. But now these dangers are over, and the spaghetti harvest goes forward.
Actually narrated by Richard Dimbleby, the Swiss spaghetti harvest brought to us there by the voice of D-Day and the liberation of Belsen. Simon, first of all, are you in general a fan of the April Fool's prank? And we're talking specifically about the media variety prank, because most news outlets do still feel obliged to do one. I generally take the view that the practical joke of any kind is the last refuge of the genuinely humourless, but do you have a different view?
I don't know. It was always said that Adolf Hitler was a fan of practical jokes. My case
rests.
I have to say. And I have sat around in conference and various newspapers and magazines. There's two things we dread. One is Valentine's. What the hell can we say about Valentine's? The other is April the 1st. And I think what's interesting about that wonderful panorama sketch there is, of course, that was an innocent time when most people didn't know what spaghetti was, of course. It was sort of foreign. So I think a lot of these pranks actually belong to an age of innocence. And I think, unfortunately, at the risk of sounding a bit po-faced about it, these days, in the times of deep fakes and concerns about the truth, they slightly feel like they've passed their sell-by date, like a packet of spaghetti.
Does spaghetti even have a sell-by date?
Yeah, I've eaten it.
Because I'm starting to think there's some things in the back of my cupboard I'm beginning to worry about. Lynn, I did want to come back to a couple of points Simon raises there, but I will admit chuckling slightly, not so much at the April Fool's prank in itself as the responses to it. Public Transport Victoria, an organisation you know well, of course, who handle the public transport in Melbourne, unveil an image of what they said is going to be the Parliament Station slide. I'm showing you a picture now. It is the slippery dip down the escalators.
Brilliant.
At Parliament Hill Station in Melbourne. Rather hearteningly for our view of our fellow citizens, Lynn, none of the responses, as far as I could tell under it, actually took it at face value. But what people were saying was like, do it. It would be amazing.
Yeah.
Although you can imagine it on a Friday night after the football is chucked out. Are you a fan of the April Fool's prank, Lynn?
I find that they can be a little bit tedious. I did like one that I read about today about... search and rescue on Dartmoor using newly trained rescue sheep.
I could almost believe that.
Yeah, with little bells on their necks and their own jackets, and they come, not so much with a little flask of whiskey like St Bernard's do, but they're very good at finding their quarry. I thought that was cute, but other than that, no. They do fall a little bit lame, and I was looking through the headlines on all the websites, and any one of those headlines could have been an April Fool's joke. One of them was power bills, like your fuel bills, goes down for the second year running. Surely that's an April Fool's line, you know? I mean, whose power bill is going down ever? Yeah. So, yeah, I think that we're in an age of unbelievable headlines anyway.
Well, there's, which is an extra reason, Simon, beyond the one you mentioned, which is that there is, well, we're caught between two things. One is that there are lots of absolutely incredible things which are actually happening. And there's also the fact that, as you were suggesting, Simon, you can go online at any hour of any day and read absolute nonsense, mostly cooked up in bad faith, which in fairness, most April Fool's jokes are not. But that being the case, even on April 1st, should news organisations take a somewhat lemon-sucking, pious, purse-lipped view of spreading misinformation, even in jest?
I think it's probably, as I said, I think it's something that there's time has come and gone. And I think, I suppose there's a kind of, vanity amongst journalists that we want to be the journalists who create the funniest, most convincing April Fool, a bit like Panorama's spaghetti or something. I think that's probably why it comes, that competition, can we do a better one than our, you know, than another title or another news outlet or something. I think that's probably what it's more about. I can't imagine, to be honest, that many viewers or readers look at these April Fool's things and think, oh, got me for a moment. what a joke. You are funny. You are clever. No, sorry.
The trouble is, as well, people do believe things. And I would like to close out by apologising to any owners of the Guinness Rock and Roll Encyclopedia, which was published at some point in the mid-1990s. Tragic though it is, there is not, in fact, a South African lizard named Codling's Gecko in honour of the keyboardist from Suede. I made that up. It wasn't April Fool's. It's just that the showbiz column for Time Out that week was short a paragraph and we didn't have much time. Let the record show, Lynn, and you'll be impressed by this as a fellow proper journalist. I did phone Regent's Park Zoo for a quote. I got them to say we have no plans as yet to exhibit the creature. There it is.
There you
bang.
Go.
So I did my job.
Good joke.
But yeah. Apologies to anybody who has written that into a pub quiz. Simon Brook and Lynn O'Donnell, thank you for joining us. Finally on today's show, the past 10 years of war with Russia have made their mark on Ukraine's film scene. A Poem for Little People is the latest release documenting the lives of those caught up in Russia's invasion. It was recently nominated for the Human Rights Award at the 2024 Copenhagen International Documentary Film Festival. Monocle's Julia Lasica spoke with the film's director, Ivan Sotkin, co-founder of the Ukrainian documentary collective Babylon 13. He began by discussing the inspirations for his latest film.
After the occupying of the Chernihiv region, I immediately go there because there is my home, there is my residence in Chernihiv, in the north of Ukraine. And met my main character, the old lady. She's 84 years old. She was in this time 84 years old. Now she's 85. And discovered that during the occupation time, she was sitting in front of the window and counting the Russian tanks by the window and sending information for Ukrainian intelligence. So I was so excited, you know, to see the old, weak person, really old lady who is so brave inside and can do so brave things. And it was very inspired me. And that was a launch point for the story. I find her friend from this village, the local poet, very naive one, but very interesting. She also became my character. And then I moved to the Donbass, to the front line, to help the volunteers' crew. And find during the evacuation of civilians from the Lysychansk, that was the time of the evacuation from Lysychansk. Lysychansk in this time wasn't occupied by Russians. So I see the completely same people, old people who are suffering, but they are choose the role of victim. You know, if those two ladies in the north of Ukraine choose the role of the heroes, they are brave and they are cool. In this place, on the front line, I see a lot of victims and seen the volunteers who are evacuating these people. So that's how I find the parallel between these characters and start to research around this one. So the film, it's like a number of little novels about the evacuees and about the evacuators. this kind of many vertical storylines, short storylines, this kind of novels, and two horizontal storylines about ladies from the north of Ukraine, from Chernihiv region, and from, about the volunteers crew who is evacuating people. Sounds a little bit complicated, but that's one more thing. This film is not really about the information. That's about the emotions mostly. So that's, you know, the title is a poem for little people. So it's a poetical form.
And I feel since kind of 2014, since the revolution of dignity in Ukraine, there's been this genre of documentary coming out from Ukraine of tracking ordinary people's lives in very extraordinary situations. And it also made me think of 20 Days in Mariupol, which also centres around the experiences of ordinary people. I was wondering if you could tell me about that. Was that a very conscious choice on your part to give emotion rather than information to an international audience about what is happening in Ukraine, the reality of what's happening in your country?
In this case, we choose emotional way of storytelling because the information could be really plastic. You know, you can interpret the information, you can bend the information, you can use the half-truths and something like this. So it's that's a case of propaganda. And we choose exactly this emotional way of storytelling to show real people to the audience. And that's working. That's a kind of a point of our success of Babylon 13. For the 10 years of our existence, we made about 400 films already and 15 feature documentaries for the different audiences, for the different medias, not only for the social medias, but for the film festival festival's audience, for the theatrical screenings, for the television channels, and so on. Now we have four feature films on the different stages of production. And also we are still publishing short stories, short documentary stories to our YouTube channel and local Ukrainian and medias around the world sharing it, and that's working.
I guess if you were talking to other directors and other filmmakers around the world in conflict zones and in war zones and to other Ukrainians, the significance of making these films for telling these stories to international audiences, would you say that there is the significance there then? Have you refound your role?
Yeah, I did. Actually, the first wish of mine in the beginning of the full-scale invasion was to mobilize, to go fight. But I choose, you know, that's a simple way to resist, you know, to take arms and go on the front line. To analyze and to make films, that's a more complicated way to resist. So I choose this role because it's, in my opinion, could be much more powerful. That's a kind of good example. It's a friend of mine, the artist, who starts to make posters in the first days of full-scale invasions, made lots of posters, very bright ones. So as a result, around the world, in London, in New York, and in other countries and other famous places, people was protesting with these posters. So and this was the way how he was sharing the slogans and sharing the logic of the situation. And also he made the video with the pictures of the war crimes. And video was projected in a European Parliament and in GAG's court and other places. And, you know, the impact was, to our surprise, was so strong. The European deputies was crying to see, watching this video from the big screen. The mood of them during the conversation inside of the Parliament was completely different. And the cinematography. This film, this the poem for little people, it's not like a piece, like an artistic thing. It's very a very, very analyzed point of view. I was trying to make the film for the very wide audience. Without I have no explosions in my film. I have no dead bodies and have no even militaries. So the things we are seeing from the news and from the most of the documentary films about the war, I choose a different angle of view just to show the war as the common life, you know. As for me, that's the most unfortunate and most painful to see how the war became a common life, you know, they replace the simple and understandable things, like our common things. So that's a kind of resistance for me, kind of way to share our situation around Europe.
That was Julia Lasker speaking to Ivan Sotkin, director of A Poem for Little People. And that is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Lynn O'Donnell and Simon Brook. Thanks also to Lena Khatib. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Monica Lillis. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.